Hi, I'm Paul Havershood, host of The Cost of Living. It's a show about money and how it shapes our lives. In big ways, like why inflation could get worse if we all make more money.
Here's the hard truth in all of this. Workers are going to have to eat that real wage loss.
And small ways, like what's the fastest way to order fast food?
That first Big Mac that comes out of the kitchen is going to the drive-thru.
Check out The Cost of Living. We're on CBC Listen or wherever you get podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens, the podcast edition. Tonight,
a force to reckon with itself. A year after the report on the deadly mass shooting in Nova Scotia, the RCMP commissioner says police culture is changing. But a firefighter who officers shot at by mistake that day says it will take more than words to convince him.
The vows of a generation. Thai politicians pass a bill that would legalize same-sex marriage. One activist says she's celebrating now, but her country still has a long way to go.
Anatomy of a fall. A structural engineer says the Baltimore Bridge collapse is a clear signal that those who build bridges and operate them need to prepare for the possibility of the kind of collision that took it down.
Home at last. When we last spoke to Farouk Samim, he was worried about his nephew, who was waiting to get out of Afghanistan with his family. But tonight, he gives us an update through tears of joy.
Less was so much more. The celebrated American composer Steve Reich remembers his late friend and fellow minimalist, the influential sculptor Richard Serra.
And bonanza of contention. Lawmakers in South Carolina have no idea where nearly $2 billion in newly discovered state money came from, and they're a bit flustered at this new pain in the assets. As it happens, the Wednesday edition, radio with an embarrassment of riches. One year after the public inquiry into the mass shooting in Nova Scotia, the RCMP is promising change. Today, the force released a strategy it says will ensure that it implements reforms recommended by the inquiry. RCMP Commissioner Mike Duhem says those changes are already underway, pointing to improvements to the public notification system, alert ready, and a digital system to track the movement of officers in real time. He admitted that the RCMP's track record on putting reforms in place was not great, but he pledged to do better.
I'm sitting here in front of you committed to say we're going to change. And the fact that we've changed the structure within the organization to allow us to better respond to the reviews and be more accountable, and we've provided the Progress Monitoring Committee the work that we've done so far. As long as I'm here, we're moving forward because I don't want this to have happened from nothing. And if we don't change, we're going to lose the trust of the Canadian public.
RCMP Commissioner Mike Duhem speaking to the media today in Nova Scotia. Daryl Curry was there watching as the commissioner spoke. He's the deputy chief at the Onslow Belmont Volunteer Fire Brigade. During the manhunt for the shooter, RCMP officers shot at him by mistake. We reached Mr. Curry in Masstown, Nova Scotia.
Daryl, the commissioner is talking about trust there. He's saying he's committed to change. Do you believe him?
I believe that he is committed to change. He seems very sincere, yes. So I would say he's personally committed. Whether everybody else is just as committed as him is the big question, I think.
You weren't invited to the commissioner's press conference this morning. How did you end up there?
I seen a CBC News clip this morning on TV that there was a news conference this morning, 10 o'clock, so I invited myself and the Chief Muse.
What did you make of that lack of an invitation? Clearly you wanted to be there. It was important for you to hear it in person.
Yeah, extremely frustrated. Well, I guess to the point of almost infuriated. The RCMP did meet with, I guess I'll call them the victims' families. There was, I think, other people there as well. Last night, there was a meeting last night where they handed out paper copies of some of the accomplishments they've had so far and had a Q&A session, I guess, with all kinds of good questions. And we didn't get invited to that, so I'm not sure. We thought we may as well go hear it firsthand.
And to remind our listeners, you know, we did speak to you a year ago when the initial inquiry report came out, and we spoke to you because as the mass shooting was unfolding, you were inside your fire hall and the RCMP shot at that building because they were under the mistaken belief that the killer was there.
Yes. So, we were certainly involved in the events that day. You know, the CERT report come out and exonerated the officers, and they not charged with anything. But as we all know, that I think through some persistence, maybe that report has been sent off to Ontario to be reviewed. So there's obviously enough, you know, discrepancy in the what happened there and how it was reported and the outcome of the report that they want to have a second look at it.
I bring up that reminder because the same day we spoke to you last year, we spoke when the inquiry issued its report to Charlene Bagley, the daughter of Tom Bagley, who was one of the people killed in that mass shooting. She said it upset her during the inquiry when the officers were asked if they would do anything differently. They said no. And it sounds like that has been your experience as well.
Yeah, for sure. That's exactly that was like very frustrating to hear that they could open fire on a civilian that they could not identify and then say they wouldn't do anything different. That, to me, doesn't make any sense. That goes, you know, back to, I think, your first question about the commissioner's comment today where about the culture. That seems to be the culture problem with the RCMP, and he's not going to change the culture of the RCMP in 1 year or 2 years or 3 years. He can change, things like having the radios identified on a screen now with the mapping, and they know where all their officers are, those techie things. Cultures, you know, a culture is going to take a generation to change. That's, to me, that's the big problem there. There's somewhat of an elitist, we don't do anything wrong, and we're not accountable, so don't ask.
Commissioner Duhem also said they're setting up a unit within RCMP headquarters that will be dedicated to that kind of cultural reform and says there will be a team focused on specifically addressing the commission's review. Does that give you any hope or a little bit more confidence that there'll be that dedicated team?
Yeah, for sure. Everything they put in place gives me a little bit of hope that, you know, that they'll do better next time. Again, it's putting a team in place is not necessarily going to change a culture. They can't go and meet with everybody and tell them, you know, all the members, you have to change your attitude and stuff like that. It just doesn't work that way.
How would you describe the impact of what happened at the fire hall specifically?
Certainly a lack of trust. There's a complete lack of trust in the RCMP. And people are still traumatized. People are still going for counseling, medication. I can speak for myself. I'm very familiar with all of that, and I know lots of others who are. People are traumatized.
I remember told us you were generous enough to tell us about what you were dealing with at the time, PTSD and depression. How are you doing now?
I would say about the same. Mm-hmm. I don't really feel much better. I've tried some different things and different medications and all that stuff, but it's a recurrent, like, it's, you know, today, for example, you know, it's a re-trigger every time, some of this stuff comes back out again. And today is obviously a particularly hard day. I think it's still important to discuss some of this stuff because, Onslow Belmont gets forgotten so often that, if we can keep it in people's minds that what happened there, I think that's important for the community.
Well, we certainly haven't forgotten Daryl, and I know our listeners haven't. I hope you keep getting the support that you need.
Yes, I hope so, yeah.
Thank you so much again for taking the time today.
All right, thank you very much.
Take care, Daryl.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Thanks.
Daryl Curry is the Deputy Chief of the Onslow Belmont Volunteer Fire Department. He's in Masstown, Nova Scotia. It is going to be a slow road to recovery for the Port of Baltimore. Authorities are still combing the waters where the Francis Scott Key Bridge collapsed yesterday after being struck by a massive container ship. Six people are missing and presumed dead. And many are wondering if the collapse could have been prevented, if the columns that support the structure had been protected or strengthened. Khalid Mosalem is a structural engineer and professor of civil engineering at the University of California, Berkeley, and that's where we reached him.
Professor Mosalem, as many of us watched what happened, we were certainly stunned and shocked by watching the complete collapse and the moment of impact. As an engineer, how did you react to what you were seeing?
It's certainly a global collapse that we do not see that frequently. And it's a very rare to see such a dramatic, rapid collapse of such a major bridge. So although we talk about these things in a classroom and teach our students about the possibility of this happening, but seeing it is very different.
Why is a point of impact like this? Why was it so catastrophic in this case?
Well, this bridge system is what is called a continuous steel truss bridge, which truss is a structural system that consists of members that form these different triangles and makes the superstructure. Because it is continuous, meaning it's supported on multiple piers, it becomes somewhat sensitive to what is called uneven or differential movement between the supports. In this case, it's not differential movement in the sense of soil moving because of some settlement. It's a lot more dramatic than this, is that one of the support is completely gone because of the ship collision. But once this support is gone, there was a very large uneven movement between the intact support and the one that was just demolished. So that led to a lot of stresses in the members of the truss, and then cause destabilization of the whole superstructure.
Are bridges around the world, or in the United States at least, that are similar to the one that collapsed, that were built more recently, what do they have that this bridge didn't, or is there a difference?
This bridge system is common in many places, that continuous steel truss system. Whether this can happen elsewhere, it depends on what kind of protective system you have in place that can take such impact from a large ship as such. There are these fender systems that is like a shock absorber that you have in your car. When you hit a bump, it absorbs that impact energy. So there could be protective systems like that in other places. Also in places like in California, where I am, where we pay a lot of attention to earthquake loading, so the columns tend to be a lot stronger than what I saw in this case, and they are able to take large horizontal forces due to earthquake shaking. So possibly in a situation of a collision like this, they will do better than what we saw in this unfortunate event.
I spoke last night on the program to a man who owns a cafe and saw what happened. He uses that bridge, drives across it every day to get to and from work. He also has a boat and goes out underneath that bridge. He said there, you know, that in the 20 years he's lived there, there's never been any safety concerns or questions about having this kind of fender system or protection. Obviously, hindsight is 2020, as he said. But why do you think this bridge did not have that kind of shock absorption system?
To be honest, I'm not sure if it had it or not. Just judging from the video and from some of the debris or wreckage photos, I could not tell if such system exists or not, but that's hard to tell. But certainly if it didn't, that would be a problem. A reason of not having it could be the fact that this bridge was built was opened in 77. So at that time, probably the sizes of the vessels or ships that cross this channel were much smaller, of less weight. So maybe there was less concern about such event from happening, because that's a very rare event. Unfortunately, it's a rare event with very high consequence.
On one hand, there are the questions about the structural integrity of this bridge. That's the basis of our conversation. On the other hand, it's quite a rare thing that a cargo ship like this, that its entire system would collapse as well, right? To then get to the point where it crashes in to this bridge. What kinds of questions should be asked on that side? I know that's not your area of expertise.
No, certainly. I mean, there has to be a very thorough investigation in terms of the maintenance record of the bridge, how often that was there any symptoms of deterioration or damage of some sort that could have weakened these piers, whether this protective system was in place or not, were there consideration to a situation of much larger ships crossing this channel, and whether any measures that are taken in place in more proper operation. So that need to be investigated, and time will tell what were really the causes of this unfortunate disaster.
Professor, I'm very glad we could speak. Thank you.
You are very welcome. Thank you.
Khalid Mosallam is a structural engineer and professor of civil engineering at the University of California, Berkeley, and that is where we reached him. And now for some good news. In December, we told you about Farouk Samim's quest to get his nephew and his nephew's family to safety here in Canada. Mr. Samim is the co-founder of Operation Abraham, an NGO that has helped more than 100 Afghans fleeing the Taliban to come to this country. But after more than 2 years, there was only one family left to save, his own. They were living in Pakistan and under threat in part because of the work he did with NATO and the international media. Just before Christmas, Farouk Samim told us about his calls to his nephew's wife, and their three young daughters to try to reassure them.
Well, the difficult part is to talk with the kids. They're like my grandchildren, and they actually call me grandpa, young grandpa. And I tell them, my children, do not worry. We'll bring you to Canada. We'll bring you to the safety of Canada, where you could go to school or you could go to park and play. And just a little bit more.
Well, 3 months later, the family is finally safe in Ottawa, and that is where we reached Farouk Samim.
Farouk, how are the little girls doing now?
That sound bites make me emotional again, but this time.
Yeah, me too.
This is the tears of joy. And the three beautiful girls are amazing. They are in the safety of our beautiful country. They're well taken care by our government in an accommodation, and full of smile, full of joy. I'm so relieved, and so are my co-founders of Operation Abraham and any colleagues who help. And this is wonderful. It's so relieving to see them here, safe and sound.
You sent our producer, Kate, a photograph of all of you together, and the girls are so, I don't know them, but their personalities are very clear in that photograph.
Yes. One of the little girls, when she was in Pakistan, she made a video talking about the difficulties and the challenges that they are facing. That's the oldest, Aisha Samim. Yeah. And she's sitting on my lap in the picture. And let me tell you, they're bundles of joy. This is a great opportunity to thank our officials and at the IRCC and everyone who supported me during that time and listened to our plea and put an end to those miseries and bring them to the safety of our country, particularly those little girls who would have no life in Afghanistan if they stayed there and all the dangers that their parents faced.
It's a joy to hear you so joyful. after all the work you and others have been putting into this. I know you mentioned they landed a couple of weeks ago. You were actually in the United States at the time. So when you got home a few days later and that reunion actually happened, what was that like?
Oh, my God. So many tears of joy poured, but all happiness, and it was wonderful. I was in the U.S. With my daughter for a soccer tournament, another wonderful former refugee now thriving. And when I came and saw the family, I couldn't believe my eyes seeing the family so happy and in front of me. Yeah.
How is your nephew and his wife? How are they doing?
They're doing fantastic. As I mentioned, they're housed in an accommodation funded by the government, by the IRCC, our immigration ministry, and soon they will be transitioned to a permanent house. All their documents have been taken care of, and soon those promises that I made to those little girls will come true, and they will go to school, and Muhabbatullah and Nilofar, his partner, have just passed their exams, and they are going to enroll in an English school and learn the official languages and get ready for their new beautiful adventure as once I did many, many years ago.
There's another adventure coming, one they're a little bit familiar with, but still, she's expecting another child.
That's right. That's right. That's, yes, Dilofar has been paired with a gynecologist who will take care of her for the rest of the time, and for safe delivery for another bundle of joy. We will name the first generation Canadian in this family, probably Lucky or Freedom, something.
Wow.
That we will remember for a very long time.
They'll be hearing a lot of stories as they start their life when they come into this world. What do your nephew and his partner, what do they tell you about what they envision for their lives here beyond the changes, you know, just in the logistics of daily life, but what they want to do, how they want to build their life here?
First of all, both Muhabbatullah and Nilofar are highly educated. One of them, a former officer, educated in law and aviation. And Nilofar Samima, a former computer science teacher in a girls' high school. They promised, and they will continue with their education. They will prepare themselves for the new life, for the beautiful life, and they will do whatever comes in terms of job opportunities and to be part of this beautiful society and to take care of their beautiful children and themselves and live here in this beautiful country.
And Muhabbatullah's two brothers we talked about last time had come to Canada before he was able to. Are they nearby? Have they been reunited as well?
Yes, they are. They are all in Ottawa. They saw the family before I saw the family, and they were so happy. And those two brothers are already integrated into the workforce, one of them working for the transportation system here. And one is working with Amazon, you know, in terms of posts and mails and stuff. So they're very, very happy. They're building their life. They're happy, so happy and relieved, like myself, that they have Muhabbatullah, Nilofar, and the beautiful children.
Farooq, when we spoke back in December, this was the last family. Your nephew's family was the last on your list at that point of people to get to safety. But things have changed. There's one other family. I know there are limitations on what you can say at this stage, but what can you share about them?
Definitely. The last family, the father of the family, is a hero whose work saved hundreds of lives in the life-saving efforts of Operation Abraham. Yes, to keep their safety and security intact. I cannot disclose their location and their names at this point. And when it's the right time, we will definitely share their story and their heroism. They're in a safe third country. Our immigration officials are in the loop. They are informed about their situation, and God willing, they will be in Canada hopefully soon.
Well, we look forward to that conversation, Farooq. Congratulations again, and thank you.
Thank you, and have a wonderful day.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Farouk Samim is the co-founder of the NGO Operation Abraham. He's in Ottawa. You have a craving for a giant rainbow lollipop. So you go where you always go when you need cash, your couch, and under the cushions you find a couple quarters and a dime. It's not enough for a lollipop, but it is a normal amount of money for a couch to contain. But what if you suddenly found another couch in your living room, one that you'd never seen before, and you turned that couch upside down and this happened? This mysterious piece of furniture, which you'd never seen before in your life or your house, just rains golden coins all over the living room until they're piled up to your waist. And you just stand there the whole time asking yourself, where did this couch come from? Why is it full of money? Who put the money in there? And what am I going to do with all of it? That is roughly analogous to what is happening in South Carolina, where state finances have been chaotic for a while now. Last year, the state controller resigned after a $3.5 billion accounting error, and now South Carolina lawmakers have learned about a mystery bank account that they didn't know about containing state money that they didn't know about. There's no record of where the money came from and no record of where it was supposed to go, and they'll need to figure those things out because the mystery account contains $1.8 billion. If financial officials know why this gargantuan sum is there, they're not talking. And lawmakers are flummoxed about how to spend money that they were unaware that they'd been saving. And sure, it is a welcome cushion, but they hadn't even known that there was a couch.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart McLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share two hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
Today, when politicians in Thailand were asked to support a bill to legalize same-sex marriage, an overwhelming majority responded with, "I do." The bill now goes to Thailand's Senate, where it's expected to pass and then be approved by the king. If it becomes law, Thailand will become the first country in Southeast Asia to recognize same-sex marriages. In Asia, more broadly, only Taiwan and Nepal have done so already. Nada Chayajid is an intersex and trans activist and a law lecturer at Mae Phah Luang University. We reached her in Chiang Rai, Thailand.
Nada, this is your work, certainly, but it is also your life. So what does a win like this mean for you personally?
Oh, it means a lot because I was witness. As I have been working as a human rights advocate for LGBTIQ rights more than 20 years. So when the law passed today, it means a lot to me. It means like everything, even we didn't get what we need in every single piece, we made some milestone, yes.
What are others in the community saying? How are they reacting?
Well, for outsiders who didn't work closely with those who submit the draft bills, they are very happy, you know, finally they can see that after have been waiting for, I think, more than 25 years. You know, like the promises, the commitment from the governments that keep passing, you know, like it's never happened before until now.
Why do you think it is happening now? Because in the past it wasn't legalized. It was backed by all the major political parties this time. Why now?
Yeah, from personal analysis, first thing I believe because everyone knows that Thailand's in before the eye of the world is a paradise where, you know, like LGBTIQ plus people, foreigners, tourists came to Thailand to express themselves and enjoy their life freely, right? Without worrying anything about being stigmatized or discriminated because, you know, as a tourist, they preserve some privilege. But in the same time, there are also the freedom of academic to allow, you know, like scholars to conduct research, which is awesome that it's time for Thailand to move forward. But without political will to make it happen, it is impossible for Thailand to pass this bill. And I'm grateful that the cabinet and the member of parliament join hands with the oppositions to make it happen. And this is the first law ever that received overwhelming comments and feedback from people, more than 50,000 engagements from people in general to support the bills. That's why these factors combine together and, you know, allows the political parties when they, you know, like ran the campaigns for the latest national elections. One of their commitment is to promote the rights of LGBTIQ people, you know, significantly, concretely. So that's why the first thing first that the Prime Minister that take his action is to sign the law as the urgent law.
You've said that, that this isn't only about the people and the communities that, that you've been working with and fighting for. You've said it's about everyone. What did you mean by that?
Because from time to time, we have been working closely with media agencies. We bring the truth on the ground about the dirty stigmatized discrimination that have been hiding under the carpet for long times. We bring the truth to power to say that, how dare you claim that Thailand is a paradise? And you even launched the campaign for tourism industries to promote Go Thai Be Free when Thai people doesn't have any freedom, you know, even just to being recognized by the law.
So what rights will this grant all couples in Thailand?
So the contract of marriage is now changing to two persons. So two person is a gender neutral term. So it means it includes everyone, no matter what they define themselves as, trans, as gay, as lesbians, as non-binary people. And most importantly, when they enter the contract of the laws, it's also create a new term, which is we call legal, not a new term, but we call legal spouse, instead of being husband and wife.
Yeah, it also means you get marital tax savings, you can inherit property, you can give medical treatment consent, so all of the things that anyone who's been
all
in that kind of relationship would know.
We have been struggling for centuries.
But you hinted at the fact that this doesn't go as far as many people wanted it to go, specifically in terms of using the term parents instead of fathers and mothers. Does it say to you that they didn't take that step?
I believe because it's related to another type of laws. You know, like when it's come to family issues, it's related to Thai rights. It means that they have to go through every section amendments. That is one of the reasons in my personal analysis as a law lecturer this day, when we had been discussed in the special committee to compile all the law, they show the intention that they don't want to do it. So that's why we want to show to the public that why, what is the reason behind why need, why Thailand and this marriage equality cannot be completed without, you know, like
that next step.
Granting the parents. As a third choice.
Do you hope or think that what you've been able to do in Thailand will mean bigger change will come across the region as well?
Well, I believe that it might influence some countries like Vietnam. It might influence them to understand that it's time for change. The wind of change is coming. You cannot avoid it. At the end of the day, you know, like marriage is not for only straight people, but for everyone who want to form their families.
Nada, thank you for your time.
Oh, thank you. I hope I answer your questions.
You did. Thank you very much, Nada.
Nada Chejid is an intersex and trans activist and a law lecturer at Mae Pha Luang University. We reached her in Chiang Rai, Thailand. Justin Trudeau has been going back and forth with provincial premiers over the future of the carbon tax for a while now, and the rhetoric is ratcheting up. Yesterday, the Prime Minister wrote to the premiers who are opposed to the tax to say that if any of them has a better plan for meeting Canada's climate goals, he'd like to hear about it. And then this morning, Conservative MPs invited Saskatchewan Premier Scott Moe to speak to a House of Commons committee. He was asked how often he had raised his concerns with Prime Minister Trudeau.
On every occasion that I've had the opportunity to speak with the Prime Minister, whether it be most recently we had a significant presence at COP28 in Dubai. I had the opportunity to speak with a couple of ministers, including the Minister of Environment in that setting. Each and every time through multiple ministers and the Prime Minister himself, we have voiced our opposition to this, what is essentially amounts to an inflationary tax. My predecessor at the very early days of its introduction, and I remember it well because I was Environment Minister at the time. I was in Montreal when the Prime Minister raised to his feet and introduced this tax on Canadians. I believe it was October the 3rd, 2016, if I'm not mistaken. But my predecessor, Brad Wall, had very quickly asked for, has anyone done the economic analysis on this? And I think what we're seeing today with the Bank of Canada's statement around the productivity emergency that we are facing in this nation tells us that, no, we haven't done an economic analysis on this policy and many others, but it's high time we should.
Saskatchewan Premier Scott Moe addressing a House of Commons committee. And he wasn't the only provincial leader speaking out. In Edmonton, Alberta Premier Danielle Smith told reporters that the carbon tax rebates won't keep up with the price of the tax, and she insisted that the Parliamentary Budget Officer's numbers back her up. Then Prime Minister Trudeau got his chance.
Conservative premiers across this country are misleading Canadians, are not telling the truth. 8 out of 10 families across the country in federal backstop jurisdictions make more money with the Canada carbon rebate than it costs with the price on pollution. It's basic math that the Parliamentary Budget Officer has confirmed time and time again. But for ideological reasons or reasons of pure partisanship, Conservative politicians across this country are not telling the truth to Canadians. And that's why I called them out. And I'm going to continue to call them out and remind them that if they really don't like our approach to pricing pollution, they can develop their own approach. Now, we expect everyone to hit the same level of ambition in the fight against climate change, because that's fair and that's important if we're going to actually make a difference in the extreme weather events that we're seeing across the country and around the world that are coming. So yes, people need to fight climate change, but any province that wants to put forward a similarly robust way to fight climate change, but do it in a way that works for them, is more than welcome to, and has been from the very beginning of our price on pollution. But Conservative premiers in general would rather complain and attack and mislead Canadians for narrow political gain because of both an ideological objection, apparently, to fighting climate change, but also to an unwillingness to recognize that we are putting more money in people's pockets with rebate checks that Pierre Poilievre wants to take away from Canadians.
Prime Minister Justin Trudeau speaking at an event in Vancouver. The works of Richard Serra seem outside of time. They're built of concrete and steel on a colossal scale, and they feel somehow ancient and futuristic at the same time. But the sculptor saw his own role in a more humble light, as he once told an interviewer from the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art.
What you try to do, and which is a hard one, is to clear away the clutter of what you've inherited from the tradition that you're working in, even though you know that you're just going to be another rock in the wall.
Richard Serra died yesterday at the age of 85. He was a one-time steelworker and a Yale-educated minimalist, or post-minimalist, to be precise. Like his abstract work, Mr. Serra cut an enigmatic figure, uncompromising and inscrutable in his public appearances. But starting in the mid-60s, he was part of a tight-knit group of experimentalists in New York that included the likes of visual artists Michael Snow and Chuck Close, and composers Philip Glass and Steve Reich, who was a particularly close friend. We reached Steve Reich in Los Angeles.
Steve Reich, Richard Serra wrote about you in 2005 when you received the McDowell Medal. He wrote, quote, "We were each other's audience and critics. The interchange of ideas nourished new approaches to materials, to time, to context, to process," end quote. What was it like then and now to have someone you were friends with and admired say that about you?
Well, it's priceless. It's wonderful. I mean, it's nice to have a good review in a major publication, but it's more important to have someone like Richard Serra say something like that, because, no offense, but I think he understands the work better than most people who are paid to do that.
None taken. How did your friendship shape your approach to making music? Because you work in two very different worlds, but there were connections.
I was living about a block around a corner from Richard in what is now called Tribeca. I was on Duane Street and he was on Granite Street. And I don't know how we initially, but we sort of bumped into each other. And I said, hey, you want to, I had just finished the piece Come Out. This is 1967, I think, 66 or 67. And I invited him up to take a listen to this tape piece, and he was just completely knocked out and he completely got it. And I went over to his place and he put me to work moving lead around, which was rolling up and putting one sheet on the wall and one sheet rolled up to be a prop. And the prop lead pieces were sort of the big signature pieces that he began his career with. And I was one of the laborers on the gig.
So you deserve some credit for the masterpieces as well.
Well, no. There was no, detailed discussion. I think with Richard, it was more a feeling of this, that he really got what I was doing, and I really got what he was doing. Let's put it this way. In Come Out, you hear the voice of a kid who was arrested for murder, and you hear it clearly, and you know exactly what's going on. When you look at Richard's pieces, there's a piece of lead rolled up, there's a piece of lead on the, it's very matter of fact. What you see is what you get. But increasingly, what you see is amazing.
Yeah.
You get more as you watch, and more as his work progressed. And hopefully somebody can say the same with me, but I'll leave that for Richard.
For anyone who's been lucky enough to travel internationally through Toronto's Pearson International Airport, they may have been introduced to Richard Serra's work there, Tilted Spheres. I've had the chance to walk through it. And for people who've only seen photographs, what you just said there, I think, is quite a powerful distillation of what people would experience if they were able to see one and experience one in person. You know, I was quite moved by what Roberta Smith wrote. They said his most celebrated works had some of the scale of ancient temples or sacred sites and the inscrutability of landmarks like Stonehenge, unquote. Is that something Richard Serra aspired to?
Well, we never talk about aspirations. We talked about, how thick is the lead?
Matter of fact.
How long is this next piece of music? What's the instrumentation that you're going to work with after the tapes? They were very matter-of-fact conversations, and for that reason, very real. Because when you have shop talk, then you really are talking.
Mm-hmm.
Richard's public work is remarkable, and the fact that you can, I imagine your piece and certainly many others, you can walk through them.
Yes.
And feel a kind of, there's a lot of tension. There was a lot of tension tension in Richard's work, because the prop pieces, if the prop wasn't exactly right, a very, very heavy sheet of lead would fall down. And that tension of it's standing, it looks firm, but there's a feeling of imminent possibility of danger. And that stays with, I think, into the cold old steel pieces as well, which I've walked through many times. And I always feel a little bit hemmed in and a little bit apprehensive and a little bit completely captivated. It's a very rich mixture of emotions, and that's part of the reason, I guess, Richard's work is so powerful in person.
You mentioned, you know, how close you lived to each other. When you first came across him, you know, rounded the corner and maybe saw him for the first time, what struck you about him?
Well, I mean, he's an intense, his work is intense, he's intense, and it radiates. He's short, he's stocky, he's there, you know. He's there, planted on the wherever he's standing. So I don't know how we started talking, but I guess it must have been based on some kind of mutual sympathy of two people just running into each other. Very few people lived where I'm describing in 1967. Tribeca, it was called at that time, I forget, it's called Washington Market, because there had been a big vegetable market there, which happened in the middle of the night. Wow. So Richard and I were sort of, everybody lived in Soho, so you took note of anybody who was down there, because there weren't supposed to be people down there. It was supposed to be an all-night market.
I hear so much joy in your voice, and you've lost a friend, and I'm so sorry for that loss. But as I said, I hear that joy in your voice, and I wonder where that joy comes from.
Well, Richard was one of the greatest artists. I suppose maybe in terms of the visual arts, he was the greatest artist that I was really close to. Mm-hmm. You know, I admire a number of people, but my admiration for him is really endless. Richard was the real deal, and from the very, very first moment of our contact. But when you meet somebody when you're young, you're both young, you're both getting started, you realize you found somebody who's really bright. You really, you know, this guy's got it. And he must have felt that way about what I was doing. And that makes an impression that stays with you till the day you die. And that's really the story.
Steve Reich, what a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you for sharing your memories. I appreciate it.
Thank you for asking me.
You take care.
You too. Bye-bye now.
Steve Reich is a composer and friend of the late sculptor Richard Serra. We reached Mr. Reich in Los Angeles. Every night in my dreams, it's the same scene. Rose slides over a bit to make some room on that piece of wood floating in the North Atlantic. Jack climbs out of the water and lies there with her. They are cold, but they survive. And their love story continues in Titanic 2. But we all know the reality is more of a nightmare. Apparently, there wasn't room for one more. At the end of Titanic, Jack sacrifices himself and dies. And now Heritage Auctions says a buyer has sacrificed nearly $1 million Canadian to buy the door frame that saved Rose at the end of that movie. The auction house says the prop is modeled off a piece of debris salvaged from the 1912 wreck and has ornate floral accents and scrolling curves. In December of 2022, as director James Cameron attempted once again to put the controversy over Jack's fate to bed, we had now-retired University of Manitoba professor Gordon Giesbrecht on the show. He is known as Professor Popsicle, and he's an expert on how extreme temperatures affect the human body. Neil asked him if Jack could have lived.
Not in the situation he was in. You know, basically, we know it was 4 hours, essentially, between when people were in the water and when rescue boats arrived. And anyone who was fully immersed, you know, up to their shoulders, they were all dead, except for maybe a handful. You know, people who were up on a raft, up out of the water, like Rose, mm-hmm. survived, or at least some of them did. But everybody who was in the water died of hypothermia. And you can see that in that where that rescue boat finally came back, and you could just see all these hundreds of people with life jackets on who had passed away. So there's no surprise that Jack also didn't survive.
You recently rewatched the movie. I can tell. You pulled out your Titanic on VHS.
My VHS. I had to work hard to find a VHS machine that worked this morning, but I did find it.
How does it hold up?
You know, it's actually good. It is actually very good. I was, when I watched it, once they came up out of the water after the ship went down, pretty much everything else after that is very realistic. And, the timing, the way that things went, and the fact that, by the time a rescue boat came back, everybody who was in the water had passed away. And that's exactly what happened.
From our archives, that was Professor Popsicle Gordon Giesbrecht speaking with Neil in December of 2022. You've been listening to the As It Happens podcast. Our show can be heard Monday to Friday on CBC Radio 1 after Your World Tonight.
And you can, of course, also listen to our show online at cbc.ca/AIH or on the CBC Listen app, or, of course, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.